This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Since the start of the war, Russia has been blocking Ukraine's ports. Nothing in, nothing out.
This does basically amount to blackmail, and it will have some pretty significant ramifications for both the Ukrainians and the wider world.
Also today, flag politics. For some Israelis, there's only one flag, theirs. Raising the Palestinian flag, they say, should not be allowed.
We respect the Arabs here, but we cannot allow anyone to disrespect our flag in our nation.
Others say the Palestinian flag is about a recognition of equality. I'm Marco Werman, plus a former head of the Louvre in Paris accused of fraud to obtain Egyptian antiquities. It's not just about relics.
The end market needs to look at these objects as blood diamonds.
All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for joining us on this Friday. For more than 3 months now, Russia's Navy has blockaded Ukraine's Black Sea ports, and that's being felt across the globe. Right now, more than 20 million tons of grain are stuck in Ukrainian silos. To put that in perspective, that is the equivalent of 200,000 rail cars fully loaded with product. Pretty staggering. Russian officials have said that they could provide a corridor for vessels carrying grain if the West lifts its sanctions. Ukrainian Western officials have called this blackmail. Joining me now is Siddharth Kaushal. He's a research fellow at the Royal United Services Institute, where he studies sea power. So if Ukraine's grain does not get out of there, help us understand what some of the impacts could be.
First of all, you're looking at a country that stands to lose around 45% of its GDP this year due to the effects of the war. And that's only going to be exacerbated by the inability to conduct maritime trade, which constitutes 70% of the country's exports. So it places immense pressure on the Ukrainian economy. Beyond that, it also has a wider impact on some particularly fragile parts of the world, parts of the Middle East and Africa, where you could see significant food shortages and rises in prices. Now, that is both a humanitarian concern, but it's also a strategic concern because food shortages tend to coincide with broader civil instability. And that sort of instability could produce cascading effects from violent extremism on Europe's periphery to flows of migration, which of course leads to the third sort of impact that the blockade could have, which I'd say is something the Russians are banking on, namely that its effects could undermine the cohesion of the coalition that's currently arrayed against Russia and cause some of the countries most directly impacted by those effects in Western Europe to push for a settlement that may be roughly on Russian terms.
Some 80 commercial vessels are stuck in ports along the Black Sea. How is Russia actually enforcing this blockade?
There's two elements to it. The first, of course, is that the level of naval mining undertaken both by the Ukrainians to defend Odessa and by the Russians means that very few ships are willing to leave port. Secondly, of course, the Russians have been bombarding Odessa almost since the beginning of the war, so they've done a fair bit of damage to the shore facilities in the port and made it quite difficult for them to operate. And the third element of it is Russian ships operating between Snake Island and Sevastopol have formed a de facto picket. Those three interlocking layers have the effect of forming a de facto blockade.
Well, right now, Turkey is in talks with Russia and Ukraine, hoping to create a Black Sea export corridor. Do you think that could be a solution? I mean, what are the pitfalls?
It could be a solution, but the question is what the terms the Russians demand for it are. So thus far, they've talked in broad terms about sanctions relief as the cost they intend to extract for a humanitarian corridor. Now, the issue there is twofold. Firstly, Turkey cannot, of course, promise that by itself. It requires broader buy-in. But the second issue is that the prospect of a humanitarian corridor for sanctions relief has the risk of splitting Western cohesion. So essentially for the Russians, it serves as potentially a way of extracting concessions. And even in the worst case scenario, if Russia doesn't get any concessions out of this, it can serve as a sort of a wedge issue.
Right. Ukraine has called on Western countries to help it lift Russia's blockade. Is that realistic? And what could it look like?
In terms of how Western countries could approach lifting a blockade, I mean, one argument that's been made is that a convoy system could be set up. Now, that's, I'd argue, not a very realistic option, both for logistical and escalatory reasons. So what I'd say is much more plausible is enabling the Ukrainians to jeopardize Russia's ability and to operate in the Black Sea. We've already seen that anti-ship cruise missiles can act as a sort of an asymmetrical force leveler for the weaker naval power. And of course, Western nations are exporting more capable missiles like the Harpoon to Ukraine. Now, if Ukraine can sink more of the Black Sea fleet's ships, the ones that are enforcing the blockade, at some point it may become very difficult for the Russian Navy to actually stop or interdict vessels in the Black Sea if it lacks the mass to do so. At that point, it might become more credible to do things like dispatch a limited number of mine-clearing vessels. So in the medium term, basically the Ukrainians could be enabled to break this blockade by themselves by essentially inflicting costs on the Russian Black Sea fleet and destroying its capacity to make the blockade effective. However, that is very much a medium-term solution. In the short term, I don't think there are very many easy ways out of this.
I mean, some have said that Putin is conducting blackmail with this blockade, a form of extortion that could leave millions around the globe facing life-threatening hunger and death. And that's according to the head of the World Food Program. Are you saying the most realistic option is for the West to keep helping Ukraine militarily and get them to keep on fighting? There are no other options?
I would say currently, yes, that is probably the most realistic option. I'd say the assessment, by the way, is entirely correct. This does basically amount to blackmail, and it will have some significant ramifications for both the Ukrainians and the wider world. I would say that in the medium term, the Russian position in the Black Sea is probably not as strong as it currently appears. You're looking at a country with a fairly limited number of ships in the Black Sea. They've lost their flagship. They can't replace their losses because the Turkish government has closed the straits. So, you know, with the right capabilities, the Ukrainians could really disrupt their ability to make this blockade credible.
Siddharth Kaushal is a research fellow at the Royal United Services Institute, where he studies sea power and maritime doctrine, speaking with us about Russia's naval blockade of Ukraine's ports on the Black Sea. Siddharth, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
For migrants at the U.S.-Mexico border hoping to seek asylum in the U.S., this has been an especially difficult week. For more than 2 years, pandemic restrictions, known as Title 42, have prevented most of those people from entering the U.S. On Monday, the Biden White House tried to end those restrictions, but a judge in Louisiana blocked that, at least for now. From the border city of Nogales, Mexico, reporter Aliza Resnick spoke with some migrants dealing with the legal limbo.
Just across the street from the border crossing, in a little plaza shaded by old trees, a few hundred asylum seekers are gathering. They're holding a protest. A line of painted cloth signs swings in the wind. One shows a family staring up at the border wall. Another sign reads, 357 days waiting for asylum. Migrants hoping to begin the asylum process in the United States have marched, prayed, and protested against Title 42 restrictions for more than 2 years now. Jesse is one of the organizers. Jesse's big brown eyes are glassy with tears. She says she arrived here with her five kids almost a year ago. They fled gang violence in southern Mexico, and that's why she didn't want me to give her last name. She says she was hopeful that finally Title 42 was going to end. But then came the Louisiana court decision.
Entonces, esta noticia a nosotros nos cayó como bomba.
The news hit us like a bomb, Jessie says. She's clutching a clipboard with her handwritten speech that she read to the crowd. Still, she says seeing all the families gathered here motivates her to keep fighting for their rights and her own. She wants people to understand that migrants in Nogales are vaccinated and tested for COVID before entering the U.S., that they're not a COVID threat. But Joanna Williams, with the advocacy group Kino Border Initiative, says now the situation for migrants stuck at the border is more complicated.
Not only did we have hopes that weren't realized, but also this becomes indefinite. This isn't a matter of a 30-day extension of Title 42. This is, well, until we figure out what the federal court system is going to do.
Last Friday, a federal judge ruled the CDC cannot lift Title 42 without allowing a public comment period or looking at cost considerations, though the policy was enacted under the Trump administration without either step. The Department of Justice is planning to appeal. In the meantime, Joanna Williams says many migrants don't have access to health care or school for their kids. She worries people here will get desperate and try to cross through the desert. Hodel, another asylum seeker from Haiti, knows people who have died taking that route, and others who never even made it that far.
Porque salieron de su país por la violencia, pero también encontraron violencia en el camino también.
People leave their country because of violence, Hodel says, and then they encounter more violence on the journey. He knows what that's like. We're only using his first name because he says he doesn't feel safe in Nogales. He and his wife left Haiti for Chile a few years ago, he tells me, after his parents were both killed in gang violence there. They had a daughter in Chile, a rambunctious toddler with curly black hair that's twisted into thick braids. She was barely two when they left Chile and headed to Mexico. Hodel says they stick out as migrants here, and they're more vulnerable.
A los inmigrantes es más peor. Es más peor. Y por la gente de color es más peor.
For immigrants, it's worse, he says. And for people of color, it's much worse. Hodel says his family has lived in different Mexican cities and bounced around the border over the last 9 months. His daughter can't go to school here. He and his wife are not allowed to work. Life is just standing still, he says. But they're still not leaving Nogales.
No podemos cruzar.
We can't cross the river and we can't cross the desert, Hodel says. It's too dangerous. The family's plan is to apply for asylum here, at the border crossing. So they'll wait until that's possible. He just doesn't know how long it will take. For The World, I'm Elisa Resnick in Nogales, Mexico.
Scientists are puzzling over research on a tree in a national forest in Chile. The Alerce Milenario may be the oldest living tree on Earth. When it was a sapling, Stonehenge was under construction. People in Egypt were just starting to write things down on papyrus. And in northern Russia, you could still see woolly mammoths. It's kind of awe-inspiring.
We live in this rapidly changing, crazy world, and it's comforting to know there's an organism there that might be 5,000 years old. It's endured a lot of changes.
Nathan Stevenson studies the giant sequoias in Northern California. He says the research on this tree in Chile could unlock many secrets from the past about climate change and more.
It could hold genes from 5,000 years ago, maybe from a warmer, drier period, who knows, that might help the species adapt to the future.
In Chile, climate scientist Jonathan Borichevich took the core samples of this still-living tree. He spoke to us today from his home, just over a mile away from the tree.
I may have been around 4 years old, 4 or 5 years old, when I first saw the tree, and I just remember the sensation of something amazing.
Borichevich went on to study climate science in Paris. Part of his doctoral studies involved dendrochronology, the science of dating trees. He and his partner extracted three different core samples of the Chilean tree, but they could not reach the tree's center with standard tools. It's just too big.
That's where I thought that we could use science, the beauty of science, to basically count, in a way, the rings that we could not see.
They used calculation to estimate what they could not measure with a coring tool. Since Borichevich announced his preliminary findings, scientists worldwide have been talking about the climate data that may come from his core samples. Each ring holds information about a year in the life of the tree and the environment around it.
we are going to be able to really encourage people to save nature, to help nature, to really realize the value of life in nature.
Jonathan Baricevich's initial findings were published this month in the journal Science. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Robert Malley, the lead negotiator for the U.S. on the Iran nuclear deal, testified to the Senate this week and said the chances of renewing the deal are, quote, tenuous at best. This comes after months of negotiations in Vienna, negotiations that have had moments of promise. So is this the end for the historic deal that was meant to stop Iran from developing a nuclear weapons program? Mark Fitzpatrick is a former acting deputy U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Nonproliferation and has closely followed the ups and downs of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, as the deal is known. Mark, what do you make of Robert Malley's comments this week?
Well, I think Mr. O'Malley was being entirely accurate while still holding out hope, however, because restoring the JCPOA remains the best option for at least preventing Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon for a few years. Without it, they're close to being able to obtain a nuclear weapon within a year or so.
So that's the take from the U.S. side. What is Iran saying?
Iran thinks that time is on its side. It is holding out for no designation of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps as a foreign terrorist organization. And it thinks that because oil prices are now quite high and it has been able to resume most of its oil sales to China, that it doesn't suffer as much from the sanctions that the former President Trump had imposed.
What are the current obstacles that have flipped this deal from seemingly promising to what seems like a no-go? What changed?
It's crazy. It's been seemingly promising for several months now. Almost all of the issues were resolved. But the one issue is this designation of the IRGC.
The Revolutionary Guard Corps, yeah.
As a foreign terrorist organization. And it's crazy because this the IRGC falls under several other U.S. terrorism blacklists. So removing this designation wouldn't by any means allow Iran to acquire any more trade. The IRGC would still be banned from any interactions. And it wouldn't increase the IRGC's foreign involvement either, because the designation hasn't stopped the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps from engaging in what we see as terrorist activities.
So why doesn't the Biden White House just remove that designation if all those other kind of definitions and classifications are still there?
Well, the Biden team certainly would like to, but they're walking a very narrow political line. Some of the Democratic members of the Senate are opposed to removing the designation, including Bob Menendez, the chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee in the Senate. So with the dice stacked against them in the Senate, they really can't make those kind of calls. Biden sought several compromises, which I think we're already leaning over pretty far backwards. He said, okay, we will keep the designation on just the Quds Force. Those are the guys who are most involved in organized overseas activities, but we'll remove it from the rest of the IRGC. Iran said no. I think Biden has tried, but he doesn't have a very good negotiating partner in Tehran right now.
Mark, what would it mean to lose this deal totally?
Losing a diplomatic means of stopping Iran's progress toward a nuclear weapon means that the United States and its partners will increasingly look to non-diplomatic means. You know, they'll impose more sanctions, but you know, sanctions haven't worked at all. So they'll be looking for sabotage, which has had some temporary success, but not very much. So what are they left with? Kinetic attacks on Iran's nuclear program, which could spark a greater war in the Middle East. So diplomacy remains the best option.
Mark Fitzpatrick is a former acting deputy U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Nonproliferation. Thank you for your time.
Yeah, happy to speak with the world.
Police in Turkmenistan in Central Asia have been raiding businesses at random, looking for contraband. It's nothing new in what's widely described as a police state, but the target of the raids in recent months have been beauty salons and women's hairdressers. The contraband includes false eyelashes and acrylic nails, according to Radio Free Europe. The beauty salon raids are part of wider restrictions on women in Turkmenistan. Here to explain more is Ruslan Myatiev, the editor of Turkmen News, based in the Netherlands. Help us understand what the government in Turkmenistan finds objectionable about false eyelashes and acrylic nails.
Well, it's really hard to say why exactly this was the target, because there have been attacks, so to say, on women for many years before. They were, for example, prohibited from driving cars, even if a woman had valid driver's license or expired driver's license, she would not be able to renew them. No reason was explained. You can imagine it's a dictatorship, it's a totalitarian country. Even in those circumstances, a handful of women found courage to go and protest in front of the traffic police department to demand their rights, and they succeeded. That was a few years ago. So this is an ongoing battle against women, so to say. Nobody expected that the very first decision of the newly stepped president of Turkmenistan, Serdar Berdimuhamedov, would be making the lives of women even worse.
So these restrictions were put in place by the new president, Serdar Berdimuhamedov. He only came to power in March. What can you tell us about him?
He is the son of the old president, Gurbanguly Berdimuhamedov. You know, everybody predicted that eventually his son would take over because Gurbanguly Berdimuhamedov was not in the best physical shape. People started to guess, okay, he's going to resign. He's going to give up his power to his son. And this is what happened, basically. Yes, they quickly held presidential elections with his son being number one, of course, and a few other candidates. We call them no names. Basically, nobody knew, you know, about their backgrounds or who they were, etc.
So basically, the son ran alone.
Absolutely. The son ran alone.
As I said, Ruslan, you're speaking with us from the Netherlands. How easy is it to get information from Turkmenistan on things like raids on beauty salons?
It's not easy. And in fact, that is one of the other things that has worsened during the presidency of Serdar Berdimuhamedov: access to internet. VPNs were blocked even before him. But now the tendency is that they block subnets. Instead of blocking one IP address or one website, they block a whole entire subnet, which leads to the blocking of thousands, even tens of thousands of websites. So popular messengers or social media platforms that you and I are used to, Facebook Messenger, WhatsApp, Telegram, Signal, whatever, is not available in Turkmenistan. Even if you manage to get a working VPN, it will only last for a day or two, then it's blocked, because it really goes like a chain. You know, they block, today they block 10,000 IPs, tomorrow they do another 10,000, and it goes on and on like that.
That's extraordinary.
People really struggle. They really struggle getting the information out. Not only that, they simply struggle keeping in touch with their relatives who live abroad.
Ruslan Myatiev, the editor of Turkmen News, based in the Netherlands, joining us to talk about what's behind police raids in Turkmenistan on beauty salons and women's hairdressers. Ruslan, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
In Shanghai, people are starting to emerge from a two-month COVID lockdown. Psychological scars are likely to linger.
Since the beginning of this lockdown, I've been thinking about the Chinese expression, Hua Di Wei Lao, meaning drawing a circle on the ground to make a prison.
Plus, a journey to Mars through music. A South African Zulu artist transports us to the Red Planet. Coming up on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. This week, the head of human rights at the UN, Michelle Bachelet, has been in China. Chinese state-run media quoted her saying she admired China's efforts to protect human rights. Bachelet's office quickly clarified she never said that. Bachelet wanted to use her trip to independently examine China's far western Xinjiang region. That's where human rights groups say more than 1 million Uyghurs and members of other predominantly Muslim groups have been put in re-education camps. Bachelet's visit comes after leaked data highlighted the abuses Uyghurs face in China, names and police photographs of thousands of Uyghurs put in those camps or in prison. Now, Uyghurs outside of China are combing through the lists to try and identify missing relatives. The World's Duri Buscarin reports.
At first, Abdulwali Ayub couldn't bring himself to search for his brother's name in the Xinjiang police files.
Because I know he was there. That's why I didn't check it.
Ayub is a longtime Uyghur activist and linguist based in Norway. He fled China after being arrested and tortured for trying to open Uyghur language schools for kids. After he left, he was quoted in several international outlets, speaking out against China's human rights abuses. Now, he knows that his brother was arrested shortly after he did that.
Until now, I don't know the real reason. I suspect it's because of me, but I didn't have any evidence.
The newly leaked documents confirm that party officials recommended Ayub's brother be imprisoned because of him. His brother was sentenced to 14 years in prison. Later, his brother's daughter was arrested and died in custody.
Same. I'm just like in prison because I don't know that. And who will be the next?
Ayub is one of many Uyghurs living in the diaspora who are combing through the Xinjiang police files right now. They name more than 22,000 people who were arrested during China's Strike Hard campaign, a crackdown that the Chinese government claimed was an effort to prevent terrorism. Thousands of booking photos show the prisoners' faces. Some are crying, some defiant. The youngest is a 14-year-old girl. Ayub says it's hard to look at.
This is a nightmare for everyone, and we have to be strong, and we have to tell the truth, and it's important. Only we can fight. We don't have any option.
China's foreign ministry spokesman Wang Wenbin called the leak lies and rumors, and the latest example of the anti-China forces smearing of Xinjiang. But the Uyghurs around the world who have identified their friends and relatives in the leaked documents say they're authentic. One woman we interviewed still has family in Xinjiang and fears they could be punished if she speaks out, so we aren't using her name or her voice. You'll hear a translator instead. When she lived in Xinjiang, authorities took her fingerprints, samples of her DNA, and even a voice recording.
You know those rooms, like at a radio studio? In those rooms, they made us read a text and recorded our voice.
She lives abroad now. A couple of months ago, she was shown a separately leaked database tied to her hometown.
I couldn't believe my eyes. In this list, there are people I know, neighbors, schoolmates. There are a lot of young people, age 18 or 20.
So far, she's found 56 people she knows. There's the woman who ran a small grocery and would always let people buy things on credit if they were in a tough spot. There's a local farmer and father of three who everyone in the neighborhood loved.
I believe none of them are guilty. These are students, farm workers, even people who are illiterate.
Most Uyghurs outside of China haven't been able to speak to their families in years. As the arrests started to pick up in 2016, speaking to family members abroad was seen as a cause for suspicion. The woman I spoke to says her relatives in China asked her to leave the family group chat.
My aunt told me, leave the group and let's not talk for a while. Then they erased me.
Today, sitting safely in her home in another country, she's scared that speaking to the press could have consequences for her relatives in China. She says she feels powerless to help, even as she looks at the names of neighbors she believes are innocent in these leaked police records.
This is the thing that makes me sad the most, because my eyes see, my ears hear, but I cannot dare to do it. I feel quite desperate right now.
And this is only a snapshot of the people swept up in China's crackdown from one part of the country. Experts estimate the Chinese government has imprisoned 1.8 million people since 2017, about 12% of the population. For the world, I'm Derry Buscarin.
On Sunday, Israelis celebrate Jerusalem Day when large crowds of Jewish Israelis march through the Old City waving Israeli flags. It's a provocative event. During last year's march, tensions spiraled into violence. Gaza militants fired rockets into Israel. Then an 11-day war broke out between the two sides. A year later, tensions remain high, and once again, flags are a focal point. Just a couple of weeks ago, the Palestinian flag was in the headlines.
The Israeli forces enter the courtyard using stun grenades, using smoke grenades.
At the funeral procession for Shireen Abu Akleh, the Palestinian journalist shot and killed while reporting in the West Bank, Israeli police rushed in, beating back mourners and grabbing the Palestinian flags on display, including one on top of the hearse. So what exactly does the Palestinian flag symbolize, and is flying it in Israel illegal or not? From Jerusalem, Yoshi Fields has our story.
For some Jewish Israelis, the Palestinian flag represents only one thing.
The enemy, to kill Jewish, to fight with us, to make war with us.
That's Miki Zohar, a member of parliament with the right-wing Likud party.
We respect the Arabs here, but we cannot allow anyone to disrespect our flag and our nation.
But for Palestinians, like activist Ali Abed, this same flag is a symbol of their identity.
For me, the Palestinian flag is about being recognized as a native who wants to be equal and as part of the Palestinian people.
Though she can also see where Jewish Israelis are coming from.
Honestly, I don't blame Israelis when they've been telling you for decades that this flag is against you and against your existence. I don't deny that there's a lot of right-wing nationalism within the Palestinian public that is saying, you know, it's our way or no way. They are talking about this, like, almost physical decolonization of Jewish people here, right? But that's a minority.
In Sally Abed's view, most Palestinians consider the flag as something less threatening.
The majority of the people that are holding flags, the majority of Palestinian citizens of Israel, we just want recognition.
What does that mean? What would that mean to get recognition
for
this land?
Freedom and equality. Freedom and equality. So freedom, I think, is for our people who are occupied, and then equality for everyone.
Though the Palestinian flag is controversial for Jewish Israelis, it's not exactly illegal here either. The flag is allowed, except when police decide it's inflaming or disrupting public order. In practice, there's a lot of ambiguity. Michael Sfard is a Jewish Israeli human rights lawyer.
Whenever the police says, or the army, that raising the flag would inflame, what did they actually mean is that it will inflame those who want to suppress the demonstration anyway.
Miki Zohar and other right-wing politicians say the policy doesn't go far enough. He's working on legislation that could punish flag flying with prison time or even lead to revoking Israeli citizenship.
I'm sorry, but we cannot allow it because this is a Jewish state. Of course, it's also a democracy. But eventually, we need to understand that this country is the Jewish country and we need to keep this idea all the time on focus. And this is something that also the Israeli Arabs need to know. If you are not Israeli, and you don't find your identity as an Israeli, and you want to show a different flag, go to the other country.
And you don't think you can have a Palestinian flag and an Israeli flag together?
No, no way. One flag for Israel, the Israeli flag.
But some will point out, you can't just wish away a whole people's identity, even if their flag symbolizes an existential question to Israelis.
What does it mean when you have 20% that are native, that are not Jewish, that are demanding recognition of this place as their homeland, to recognize the ethnic cleansing, to recognize the Nakba? It really rocks the foundations of Zionism.
Most of Sally Abed's activism is done working together with Jews, many of whom consider themselves very left-wing. But when she's with them, she doesn't raise the flag. Even in solidarity work, she's found that Jews are scared of the flag, uncomfortable being affiliated with someone holding it.
It's very hostile for them. So, like, I choose my battles, and I do choose not to be just right and ideological, but also strategic and actually win. We need to win. We need to win. We don't have the privilege to just be right as Palestinians.
The attempt to erase Palestinian identity and nationalism can be seen in many aspects of Israeli society. For example, for Abed, growing up in northern Israel, she never learned in school about Palestinian culture and historical perspective, but only about Jewish history, the Holocaust, Israel's fight for independence. What's happening with the flags, Abed says, is just another example of that erasure. Referencing the recent funeral of the Palestinian journalist where flags were removed by Israeli police, she says,
it was like such a physical representation of Israeli forces trying to maintain control of the narrative.
In East Jerusalem specifically, there's been an attempt by right-wing Jewish Israelis to push Palestinians out. Israel took control of East Jerusalem after the 1967 war. And in these areas, Israeli police have made a point of removing Palestinian flags and arresting protesters for holding them. I spoke about this with Mohaned Anati, a resident of East Jerusalem.
I don't think that the flag will come and take Israeli state away. The flag is not an aggression. It's soft. Exactly, it's soft.
By soft, he's referring to the flag being made of fabric.
If you keep trying to pressure the Palestinian people in this issue, the Palestinian people will try to raise and wave the flag more and more times.
Anati is a field worker for the Association for Civil Rights in Israel. The group has filed a petition that would make it harder for Israeli police to confiscate Palestinian flags. The real issue here, according to lawyer Michael Sfard, is not the flag. It's whether a group of people is inciting violence. And there seems to be a double standard here.
The Israeli flag is being raised by people who call death to the Arabs. So will we outlaw the Israeli flag?
On Sunday, crowds of Jewish nationalists will be waving Israeli flags on Jerusalem Day. And they'll be chanting that the city is Jewish. In the past, marchers have gone straight through the Muslim quarter of the Old City. Meanwhile, Hamas in Gaza is threatening to fire rockets if the march continues as planned. For The World, I'm Yoshi Fields, Jerusalem.
Shanghai is beginning to ease its two-month-old COVID lockdown. New infections are falling, and in some neighborhoods, residents are being allowed to venture outside their compounds. Even so, as we hear from Shanghai writer and translator Xing Zhao, the restrictions still have residents on edge, and the psychological impacts are likely to linger for a while.
Last month, my boyfriend and I lined up to take a routine PCR test in my apartment compound. Despite some grumbling, all residents are required to take it almost every other day. That evening, around midnight, we both received phone calls from an unknown number.
Why?
A cold, authoritative male voice who identified himself as a staff member of the Center for Disease Control in our district informed us that our test results had been abnormal. He instructed us to stay at home and wait for health workers to come the following day to conduct a new test. We both had a hard time falling asleep that night. The next morning, I heard a sound at our entranceway. I went over to it, thinking it might be health workers who had come to retest us. But I opened the door to find a barrier of white tape. To be honest, at first I didn't understand the purpose of the tape. We were already locked inside the compound. If I had wanted to come out, I could have easily broken through the tape. Later, I came to realize the tape's work was invisible. It made me feel as if I had done something really bad, like I had committed a crime. Since the beginning of this lockdown, I've been thinking about the Chinese expression, hua di wei lao, meaning drawing a circle on the ground to make a prison. When barrier tape is stuck on your door and used to seal off your streets, the largest barriers are psychological. It feels harder to come out. We spent most of that day waiting for the health workers to appear at the door for a repeat of the test. We'd heard stories that sometimes they didn't come for days, and some of the unlucky are taken to a centralized quarantine facility even before they had the chance to retest. Each time we heard a sound near the door, we grew nervous. As the lockdown continued, measures to keep people inside grew more draconian and absurdly creative. Inflatable dolls, dressed in white hazmat suits, guarded some apartment buildings, perched on the walkways, like scarecrows. My compound has three gates. Two are locked. The third is monitored by two security guards and is only open when a delivery arrives. Later in the day, workers in hazmat suits showed up for our retest. They were two young women, polite and adept at the job. The next day, we got our new test results in the designated COVID prevention mini-app on WeChat. They were negative. Looking at the barrier tape, now ripped in half but still firmly glued to the door, I felt both relieved and angry. Relieved because we won't go into a centralized quarantine facility this time. Angry because we had been shown such brutality in the name of safety. Finally, after being confined inside my apartment for 55 days, this week we were given passes that allowed us to go out of the compound for a couple hours. The sudden freedom felt unreal. Walking down familiar streets that I hadn't set foot on in almost 2 months was like seeing a city that survived a tornado. My boyfriend and I took a long bicycle ride until we were exhausted. In many of the neighborhoods we passed, the tape and fences are gone. I've heard that the restrictions will soon start to ease further. But the psychological barrier that has taken shape in our minds still remains.
That's writer and translator Xing Zhao in Shanghai. The globe is at an energy inflection point. The urgency of climate change and the war in Ukraine have nations scrambling to rethink their energy sources. Monday on The World, we're devoting our entire hour to stories about energy, how we make it, how we use it, and how our thinking about energy is changing. Join us for that special hour this Memorial Day on The World. At a time when museums are talking about repatriating ancient relics back to their countries of origin, a former president of the Louvre in Paris is alleged to have gone in the opposite direction. Jean-Luc Martinez is charged with concealing the origins of ancient Egyptian artifacts. These objects were possibly trafficked out of Egypt during the chaos of the Arab Spring Uprising in 2011. With us is Monica Hanna. She's an archaeologist and a professor at the Arab Academy of Sciences in Aswan, Egypt, and joins us from Cairo. Monica, what was your reaction to hearing this news, that the former head of the Louvre was taken in for questioning by Paris police for fraud, concealing the origins of various Egyptian artifacts?
Well, Marco, I'm not surprised, because we've known that many museum directors and curators have been buying objects that have definitely left their countries of origin in an illegal way. Almost every week, I get tips from friends in different museums and different institutions. Ah, look, they've acquired this, but they're putting it in storage until people forget the Arab Spring. And then the objects would go on display. And I'm sure there are hundreds more objects that were illegally bought by different museums.
I got to say, I'm surprised to hear that you're not surprised, because while museums and activists are saying repatriation of these objects now, this thing is happening at the same time. Has this basically been an open secret the entire time?
Yes, indeed. And many people know what's going on in big museums.
Do we know then how suspicion fell on Jean-Luc Martinez, this former head of the Louvre?
We know that the objects that were stolen, this deal of Tutankhamun was not published before. And it's very, very weird that such an important object would be at the Louvre without being published. So people started asking questions and looking, especially after the Nejman sarcophagus that was repatriated from the Metropolitan Museum was also sold by an antiquities dealer in Paris.
Tell us about that sarcophagus. What does it look like and why is it significant?
It's beautiful. It's gilded and it's from the 26th dynasty. And we found out that it was stolen because the looter who had it in his home here made a video of it and circulated it for buyers. And this video, by chance, fell in one of the hands of the honest Egyptologists who reported this to the police. Then New York District Attorney took action and repatriated it.
So what happened with the uprising that allowed for these artifacts to go missing? I mean, do you believe the distraction of the revolution played a part?
Yes, and also as of the 28th of January, the police withdrew. So with the police withdrawal from major archaeological sites, looters went around, I mean, huge villages used to go on picnics for illicit digging. I mean, you can track the digging from the satellite images and see its progress in many of the sites.
Incredible. What do you think authorities in Egypt and other countries in the region can do to stop the trafficking of these valuable items?
Many of these countries are currently challenged. They need to work with the security. They need to work with the awareness, but also the market, the end market needs to look at these objects as blood diamonds.
Is it a few bad apples or do you think this problem is going to continue?
No, I think this problem is quite inherent. And I think it has to do with this idea of the museum as an institution of power that started with the colonialism. So the more we also repatriate objects to their countries that have been taken under colonialism, we break this chain where the power is no longer in the object. And so museums will start to rethink their role in the 21st century, that it's no longer a place that has unethical objects in it.
Monica Hanna is an Egyptian archaeologist and a professor at the Arab Academy of Sciences in Aswan. She joined us from Cairo. Monica, thank you very much. We really appreciate it.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you, Marco.
Some people who are excited by space travel are drawn to the idea of a new world that doesn't have the problems here on Earth. That was some of the thinking from Muzi, a Zulu musician from South Africa, when he recorded his latest album, Interblactic. He transports listeners to Mars. Here's Muzi.
With Interblactic, what you're hearing is when African people travel to another place, Mars, another planet, and then when we get there, just to like sort of create a new sort of planet where we're not like subdued to anything that happens on Earth. So that was like the sort of concept I had like in my head.
Told you I'm a boss, you've ignored that. How's that for a throwback?
Playing around on African spirituality with regards to us going into another dimension, but then using Mars as that destination.
Integrity intact, black skin, free man, love it, oh, move over.
I always play around like space themes, and I like the idea. I'm like very nomadic because of like my career. So I'd move around, I've lived in a few different countries, and like I think the whole space theme like speaks to me continuously going for something. So like the chasing of the dream, like the chasing of the thing that's bigger than life. And I just like playing around with those concepts so that I can write about my own life, but make it almost movie-like. So many things to do. Ironically enough, like the music, even though like I love speaking about being on this journey and on this pursuit of like my happiness and stuff, like the whole album was made during the pandemic. I couldn't really go anywhere. So there's a lot of imagining stuff. I even have a song on the album called The Traveler that speaks on like going and seeing new people and meeting new people with a Portuguese artist called Daltino Guerreira. Yeah, like it was just like, because I was at home and we were all under lockdown, it was a good time for me to like try and like imagine how the world would be when it reopened. So ultimately, like what it comes down to is that the music is really like therapy for me. So I create these things that I want to see in my real life. But with music, I'm able to get there instantly because I'm just writing the song down. And obviously, life is a bit slower than just like imagining something and making it become real. So the music has always been a way for me to escape from like my like current like situation. I come from a very poor background. So that's why I always used to make music that like made me happy and made me like travel into distant places because of how my current situation wasn't ideal for me at the time. So I still carry on with that thread of just like making music that heals and making music that helps people remember like who they are.
Muzi is a Zulu musician from South Africa. Starting this weekend, he'll be on the road here in the U.S. to promote his new album, Interblactic. And that is our show on this Friday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH. I'm Marco Werman. Have a relaxing Memorial Day weekend. Yeah.